Thanks for doing.
Your Honor, on behalf of the Hospital Association, I'd like to thank the court for the opportunity to address the issues today. The message that the Hospital Association asks the court to send to doctors practicing at a hospital is simple and direct. If you want contractual protections, go and get a contract. Contracts of this nature are commonplace. They spell out the responsibilities and rights of both sides, the doctors and the hospital. They establish a duration. They establish when a contract can be terminated and the grounds for termination, and more. They give a doctor contract rights and the additional protections of the implied covenant. The flip side is that a doctor should not expect that the medical staff bylaws will be a substitute for a commercial contract. The bylaws may entitle you to a hearing on credentialing decisions, but no more. And beyond that, you merely have the same rights as any other interested party to bring a challenge under Berman and seek an injunction if the policy the hospital is pursuing does not advance a healthcare objective. You know, the plaintiffs here had no contract. They pled no contract other than the medical staff bylaws. And to fill in the gap, they have sought to contort the medical staff bylaws into a commercial contract substitute, a concept that's never been upheld by any court and that is contrary to the purpose and history of the medical staff bylaws. Those bylaws were intended to organize the medical staff at a hospital as a form of self-governance and do not define a commercial relationship between the doctor and the hospital. And they were certainly never intended as a check on the power of a hospital board to pursue managerial decisions deemed to be in the interest of the public. Those managerial prerogatives allow a hospital board to pursue all sorts of strategies, including alignment strategies, including exclusive contracts. And as this court has, and many other courts have recognized, exclusive contracts have many advantages in efficiency in the delivery of healthcare, including fostering better working relationships between the hospital's personnel and the doctors performing procedures, standardizing procedures, ensuring round-the-clock coverage, improving scheduling of procedures, and more. And most fundamentally, an exclusive contract aligns the hospital's interests with the interests of the physician group, creating a true partnership that seeks to best serve hospital patients. That's not to say there's no check on hospitals' managerial decisions. We all know that there's the Berman case law, which defines when and how a challenge might be brought. That case law makes clear that hospital decisions are entitled to, are reviewed under a standard that is even more deferential than the direct deferential standard we employ when we review administrative agency decisions. And in response to Chief Justice Rabner and Justice Patterson's inquiry this morning, if a hospital seeks to defend its policy using falsified data or skewed data, and a judge makes that finding, and there's no other evidence to sufficiently support the hospital's decision, then the hospital policy will fail. But if the hospital policy passes the Berman test, that's the end of the story. There's nothing should be implied in the bylaws to create a further avenue to challenge the hospital's decision. Now, as this case has progressed, the plaintiff—
Can I ask you a question about evidence? What does a hospital need to present in order to justify a healthcare decision under Berman?
Well, it depends obviously on the healthcare decision being defended and what sort of evidence is appropriate in that circumstance. That vague answer that may not help you. But here, it's well recognized that in case law, it's enshrined in decisions. There's a very strong opinion by, a concurring opinion by Justice O'Connor, spelling out the advantages of an exclusive contract. And so the question here that I think a hospital board member would be confronted with in this particular instance would be, will the association with the Columbia Group mean that the hospital is associating with a second-rate group of doctors who will diminish healthcare at the hospital, and that the hospital would be better off with the current situation, which is no exclusive contract?
That seems like such a low standard. It's actually below ground. I mean, that puts the burden on the person seeking to attack the hospital's decision, doesn't it?
The I don't know about the below the ground component. I would agree that
it has to worsen healthcare in order to.
Well, there are advantages. The standard isn't that to reap the advantages of an exclusive contract, you can't have a secondary impact of worsening healthcare. You get advantages from going on an exclusive arrangement. And, you know, Valley's no exception to the rule. They've done exclusive contracts in multiple areas. And there's an experience base at Valley, and I'm sure at other hospitals as well, that there's substantial advantages to the development and advancement of a particular line of service by going with an exclusive contract.
Does the hospital have the burden to show that the decision was made for purposes of improving healthcare?
The word I would object to is purposes. The question is whether it improves healthcare.
So
there are always multiple motivations. Hospitals are very complex organizations. There are always multiple points of view. There are always substantial frictions in the hospital. It is always easy to say that you are singling me out of animosity or some other bias.
If a hospital hypothetically is actually getting rid of a group of doctors because of personal animosity, but stumbles across the finish line and it really does improve healthcare because patient outcomes improve in the 5 years following that decision, the hospital's met its burden under Berman?
I think it has. The question is whether the hospital is acting pursuant to the public interest.
And if I think that to say simply that it happens to, tell me if I'm wrong, I understood Berman to be focused on the reasons for the decision.
I understood Berman to be focused on whether or not the decision will have the result of improving healthcare, because the reason for the judicial review was to ensure that the public interest was being served, and the public interest in quality healthcare. And if the decision serves quality healthcare, but pursues that and also happens to pursue some administrator's personal animosity towards a particular physician or physician group, should the hospital not be allowed to implement that particular practice, and should the court enjoin it? I don't think that's what
I'm suggesting. I just want to get at what is the relationship between the healthcare improvement and the hospital's decision. I thought it was along the lines of the decision is made in order to improve healthcare outcomes or in furtherance of a policy of improving healthcare outcomes, which to me suggests that you look at the decision itself, not simply whether it turned out well or not.
Well, you won't know whether it turned out well in most of these cases because it's an injunction action.
Right.
And so the question is whether there are a substantial rational basis decision.
That's and closer the rational, to what I was thinking it was.
So like when you review an administrative agency action, you don't question whether the state administrator didn't like the particular had some animosity that he or she was pursuing. You question whether the policy is arbitrary and capricious or unreasonable, and this is subject to an even more deferential standard than that.
Can I ask you then a question about the burden of proof? Because it sounded like you were agreeing with Justice Patterson that the burden is on the hospital to justify their decision. In an agency review circumstance, the burden is on the challenger to show that the agency's action was arbitrary and capricious. Here, who is the burden on? Is it on the hospital to show that their decision was something, or is it on the challenger to show the decision was not X, whatever it is.
I don't think there's any case law that spells that out. I think that the hospital is going to have to come forward with the grounds that support its decision. And whether that's done in the first instance or by way of rebuttal, it will not prevail unless it does that. In terms of the burden of persuasion, I think the standard is quite clear in Berman that if the evidence shows that the hospital is reasonably pursuing a healthcare agenda, the court should stay out of the, should not intervene, should leave the hospital to proceed. But honestly, Your Honor, it has not been addressed in any decision I'm aware of. As this case has progressed, it has morphed. And plaintiffs appear to have conceded that the medical staff bylaws alone cannot support their award. And it's not entirely clear. They say that there's a broader foundation for their claim, and it's not entirely clear what they mean by that. But it might mean that there's an implied contract of the sort you talked about this morning, Justice Solomon, or it could mean that there's an oral contract. And I think either of those doesn't hold up. An implied contract claim in this instance is that their rights are based on the medical staff bylaws, plus the work that they did at Valley to help develop and advance a neurosurgery program. But as members of the organized medical staff, every doctor is obliged to serve the hospital. And the fact that a doctor performs certain functions that advance healthcare at the hospital does not constrain the hospital board from pursuing a policy that's in the best interest of the community the hospital serves. And if you adopt an implied contract theory, what you are essentially saying is that the medical staff bylaws for all doctors at a hospital who participate in the self-governance of the medical staff create contract rights. And that would be a very unusual determination, and it would be one that the Hospital Association believes is very much against the public interest because it will constrain hospital boards from implementing reform.
I just want to read you something from Berman that suggested, at least to me, that it's the hospital's burden. And this is it. It's page 113. We conclude that the hospital has failed to marshal adequate information that demonstrates that its particular restrictive admissions policy is sufficiently related to a genuine and legitimate healthcare objective. Does that suggest to you that it's the hospital's burden?
Well, it depends what you mean by burden, Your Honor. I acknowledge that the hospital has to make the case, if that's what you're referring to. If you're dealing with the more technical issue of burden of proof and burden of going forward that we often deal with in cases, I don't know that that addresses that. I think what Justice Handler there is saying, and I don't have it in front of me, is the hospital's got to make its case. It's got to show that this policy actually advances healthcare. And if the evidence that the hospital marshals doesn't do that, or the evidence that the plaintiffs marshal shows that they don't do that, it doesn't do that, then the court will enjoin it. But otherwise, the policy stands. The other rationale that the plaintiffs seem to use to support the verdict is this oral contract. They say that based in 2002, Valley came to them and induced them to bring their practice to the hospital and made an oral commitment to allow them to practice at Valley perpetually so long as that they were adequately credentialed. Now, that argument has nothing to do with the bylaws. It does not establish a broader foundation for their claim. It establishes a whole new foundation for the claim. It's a straight oral contract claim. And from a hospital lawyer's perspective, and from the Hospital Association's perspective, the concept that this sort of commitment would be made orally, though theoretically possible, is unheard of. This is would be a major managerial decision for the hospital and for the physician group. And to think that it would be made in an off-the-hand conversation is hard to imagine. But the bottom line is that the hospital should not lightly be found to have surrendered such a fundamental managerial prerogative in a conversation. Instead, there should be unassailable evidence that such a commitment was made and establishing the boundaries of the commitment. For example, here, what was the term of the commitment? On what grounds could the relationship be terminated? Even who are the parties covered by the purported agreement? Plaintiff's group went from two doctors in 2002 when these discussions were held with Valley to 12 doctors when the agreement with the Columbia group was entered. Does the agreement apply to the 10 doctors who later became associated with the original practitioners? Before you find an oral contract constraining a hospital's managerial discretion, those sorts of questions and many more need to be answered. It can't be an offhand statement of the most generic nature. I'd also like to address one argument made by the plaintiffs in their most recent briefing, and that is that this is a unique case, sort of a one-off. And the Hospital Association has overstated the concern that the medical staff bylaws could become a new way for doctors to resist organizational changes that disserve their personal interests. I wish that were the case, but a recent lawsuit makes clear that it is not. The lawsuit, which I just learned about on Monday, was brought this summer by Mr. Venero's firm on behalf of a group of neurosurgeons against the Atlantic Health Group and its hospitals. It concerns a center where the hospital system was centralizing the treatment of brain tumors. I don't have any special knowledge of the lawsuit. Everything I know about the lawsuit comes from going on e-courts and reading the complaint. But the doctors bring not only a Berman claim, but they bring a claim based on the medical staff bylaws and the implied covenant under the medical staff bylaws. The case does not appear to be identical to this case. Cases never are. But there are very, very strong echoes. The docket number is BER-C- I have it as 131-23, but I seem to remember it as 133-23.
How does this help us?
The plaintiffs have made the point that all of the concerns that the Hospital Association has stated about the bylaws becoming an end run around Berman are overstated, that this is a one-of-a-kind case that has unique circumstances. You're never going to hear about this again. Well, we already see the next case coming down the road. And I suspect, depending on this court's ruling, it'll be not only that next case, well, hopefully not based on this court's ruling, but if the court rules in the plaintiff's favor, based on this court's ruling, there'll be more cases and more cases. And Berman will be, over time, increasingly irrelevant. All of the sound reasoning in the Berman and Desai line of cases, which go over half a century, will be set aside, and we'll be seeing increasing challenges to hospitals' managerial decisions brought by affected physician groups and others claiming that it breached the implied covenant in the medical staff bylaws. And implied covenant law is respectfully somewhat amorphous. Those claims go to a jury. Hospitals, that's a very scary prospect for hospitals. And that's the importance of that case. It shows that this is not a one-off, that this case does have significant precedential and institutional consequences for the healthcare system, the hospital care system in this state. From the perspective of the Hospital Association, the lawsuit underscores the importance that Berman remain the singular vehicle to challenge a hospital's board's managerial decisions. Under Berman, the North Star is whether the policy should be enjoined because it's not shown to advance a legitimate public health objective. The medical staff bylaws have no role in that judicial assessment, and they can't be employed as they were here to create an avenue to sidestep the Berman inquiry and as legal grounds for a jury award in the tens of millions of dollars. Unless the court has further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Venera?
Thank you, Your Honors. Chief Justice, Justices, may it please the court. Some cases are so fact-sensitive, so deeply lodged within the province of a jury, they must be won or lost before jurors and not appellate courts. This is such a case. Jurors heard overwhelming evidence allowing them to conclude that Valley's white paper was no more than a pretext to oust plaintiffs. Valley's perceived lack of loyalty on the part of plaintiffs drove this process rather than any good faith effort to improve health care. That core reality, as seen by jurors, should inform the court's consideration of the three issues on which it granted certification. First, the trial court properly submitted the implied covenant claim to the jury. The contract that gave rise to that claim rested on a foundation broader than Valley's medical staff bylaws. Plus, before the trial court, Valley strategically supported including the implied covenant claim so as to eliminate other claims, and it should be held to that position now. Valley argues that the summary judgment observations made by the trial court when dismissing the CEO and the board from this case somehow disqualified the jury from later considering the implied covenant claim. Valley's perspective on summary judgment is wrong. Trial courts make no findings of fact when deciding summary judgment motions. The trial court made none here. The trial court simply considered the pretrial state of the record and concluded the contract at issue was between plaintiffs and Valley as an institution, not between Valley's CEO and its board. The trial court's interlocutory analysis about the white paper's purported findings cannot override what was later proven at trial. There is nothing in the jury's verdict or the appellate division's non-precedential decision that would trespass on some future board's ability to enter exclusivity arrangements, so long as the basis for doing so rests on valid healthcare reasons supported by reliable data. Respectfully, a sham study does not satisfy that standard. Second, there is no reason to disturb the lower court's determination that Valley had waived the attorney-client privilege that may have attached to certain emails. Through those emails, Valley's general counsel did more than dispense generic legal advice. As the lower court concluded after an in-camera review, counsel was deeply involved in the genesis and makings of the white paper. Once Valley exalted that paper as the reason to oust plaintiffs, the emails were put in issue and any privilege had been waived. As for the third issue, the brief reference in plaintiff's closing argument to the lack of certain patient transfers being presented is no reason to upset a trial that spanned four consecutive weeks, included 22 witnesses, and over 1,000 pages of exhibits. When placed in context, that comment was fair and accurate, in contrast to the blatant falsehoods and the other problems associated with comments made by the cases cited by Valley. Nor did the issue of plaintiff transfers dominate the trial as expert testimony, as in the Bender case, again, one of those cases that Valley has relied on. Here, the trial court judge did not foreclose, and this is a critical point, Your Honors, did not foreclose Valley from admitting evidence of purported transfers. The judge simply found it inappropriate to do so on cross-examination of a particular witness. Valley declined to pursue the supposed evidence through other means, and under those circumstances, there was no error, let alone plain error, in allowing the fleeting, accurate remark in the present case. Lastly, now that there's been full supplemental briefing and we've heard references to the supplemental briefing and the opportunity to review this highly fact-sensitive case, plaintiffs would respectfully urge this court to vacate its grant of certification or, in the alternative, affirm in all respects. And I'm happy to answer the court's questions.
What is the precise contract beyond the bylaws that you rely upon?
I take a slightly different view, as you might imagine, to the contract here. First, I would like to, in answering your question, Your Honor, because I think there was some discussion or some question about this, the facts that alleged this contract beyond the bylaws were stated before the summary judgment judge. They're in the statement of facts that plaintiffs submitted. That's at 58.1A, and it was also in, that was in our summary judgment brief, and was also in the statement of facts submitted to the trial court. That's at DA 2099, and it was also listed in the complaint. The facts were the amended complaint. The contract originated from Valley reaching out to my clients. That's how this all began. Valley extended the offer because Valley had a critical need to build up their brain and spine center, their neurological division. They needed better equipment. They needed staff. They needed the infrastructure. There was an outgoing group, a relatively small group, or perhaps a group that was on the eve of retirement. And they said, this outgoing group, basically, we can't do this anymore. We can't do on-call. We can't do emergencies.
So we understand that Valley initiated contact with the plaintiffs in order to build up the neurological practice. But as the Chief Justice asked, what is the contract that you are relying on that goes beyond the bylaws that say nothing about exclusive or rights to have privileges to the emergency department in perpetuity and actually say something different?
The contract is what Dr. Roth testified to. He used the words quid pro quo.
So an oral contract.
It was an oral contract, but it was also a contract based on performance of the parties. So it wasn't entirely oral.
So a contract that would have allowed for a particular group of doctors to, in perpetuity, have privileges at a hospital, at the hospital's emergency department, that's a pretty significant lucrative contract, I think we would all agree. What is your response to Mikas's argument that such a contract should be in writing and have some boundaries, and such contracts are common in the medical industry because who was covered by the contract? Every doctor that ever joined this practice group will also be covered under this oral contract? We don't know because it's not in writing. How long will it last? Is it just in perpetuity because at some point in the past, this group assisted the hospital in building up this department? Such a lucrative contract in this industry where contracts are very common, seems as though it should be in writing if that were the case. For both parties, on both parties' ends, I would think that there would be a writing.
I understand the question, and I disagree with the premise of it respectfully, and I realize you're echoing what Amiki has said. Our position is not that this contract was in perpetuity. Our argument here is that the contract was in place for as long as plaintiffs were doing their job and upholding their end of the bargain, at which they were. And I don't think there's any dispute about that. They built up the center. They got the equipment. They earned this hospital the first ever Bergen County Award in this area. They built up their staff and so forth. Until such time as there was a valid health care reason to shift to some other arrangement.
What are the terms of the contract? Is that it, or is there more?
The terms of the contract are, we get the benefit of our bargain, which is, at the very least, we get to use this equipment. We have privileges. We have our share of on-call duty the way it was assigned. Those are the basic terms. And this is a critical point. Everyone sort of knew what those terms were. Why? Because that's what was happening for about 8-9 years, undisturbed. It was only when Valley became, and forgive the raw terminology, just basically obsessed with competition from other hospitals, that they began this process of figuring out a way to disavow plaintiffs. That's when the relationship started to sour.
Are the bylaws and the rules and regulations for the medical staff that talk about the on-call schedule, is that in conflict with your understanding of this contract that these doctors would have privileges for as long as they were doing their job and it's fine? Because the rules and regulations for the medical staff state that the on-call schedule is not a right or a privilege and can be removed at the discretion of the department.
We believe that the on-call was clearly part of the bargain, the expectation.
Well, what I'm saying is you have it written in the bylaws, and you have it written in the rules and regulations of medical staff that is incorporated in bylaws, but that's not the case.
Yes.
That's correct, right? That's written down.
That's the way I read. I saw that language in the bylaws. I would answer the question this way. If their argument is there was a process under the bylaws to work out some of these things, like what Your Honor is saying, that would be one thing. But they're saying nothing we had argued about, nothing we had complained about could be adjudicated, if you will, under the bylaws. This would be a very different case if Valley came to us rather than a 13, 14 month maneuver around the bylaws. If Valley had come to us and said, we have some problems, we got to go to the bylaws, we want to give you a hearing, we want to work some things out, and by the way, we may now have a valid healthcare reason to go with a different group, that would be a different case. That's not this case. This case is, and this goes, I think, to Justice Patterson's question, is what are the Berman factors? They're really basic. There has to be a regular course of business in which a valid healthcare objective is trying to be achieved, and the process and the information about which the board goes about achieving it is reasonable and reliable. This process failed on all three counts. It was an irregular process, and I'll get to that in a moment. The healthcare objective was not legitimate, as Justice Handler said it should be. The healthcare objective, and I haven't heard any dispute on this because there really is none, was to oust our plaintiffs. And the reliable information clearly was not satisfied because, and it was not just an allegation that the information in the report was manipulated. The jury basically found that. That was proven.
And going back to the Chief Justice's question about the parameters of the oral contract, I just want to make sure I understand. The parameters of the oral contract, based on your argument, is that everyone knew that the plaintiffs would have privileges in the emergency department, would have privileges to using the equipment for as long as they wanted, as long as they were doing their jobs and performing their duties in the emergency department.
So long as they were upholding their end of the bargain, or...
And what was upholding their end of the bargain was doing their job as doctors.
Well, it was continuing to staff the equipment. Remember, Dr. Walzman, he was on call, I think, for many years, even with very few breaks, of moving their offices closer to Valley, of staffing up. My colleague,
moving the offices closer to Valley, you're saying was a requirement under the contract?
It was a basic understanding at that part of the conversation with the CEO, Myers, was that plaintiffs would help with equipment, help with personnel, move their offices, or at least be accessible, and to service clients and patients, and give Valley what they didn't want but desperately needed, which was a center of excellence.
Your and clients were sophisticated CEO, parties. Mm-hmm. Aren't basic understandings between sophisticated parties usually committed to writing so that you don't have a court saying what are the terms of the contract? And instead, you have to wait till trial to hear someone say, this is what I expected?
Yeah. Well, are you asking me as a matter of, as a lawyer, would it be better to always put everything in writing? Perhaps, but there are all kinds of disputes about that as well when something's in writing. The jury found a contract, as Justice, I think it was Justice Solomon, suggested. The jury was given the model charge on contract.
Can I ask you a question about that? I'm sorry to interrupt you. On the breach of contract claim, the jury found that a contract existed, although they found Valley did not breach that. What contract do you believe were they referring to? Was that the bylaws? Is that the separate agreement? What do you suggest that they found in that circumstance?
I will give a similar answer to what my colleague, Mr. Perino, suggested. Well, we'll never know exactly what's in the jury's mind, but we do know how the jury was charged, and we know what the judge was thinking about when he charged the jury. Toward the very end of the charge conference, and this was after the judge heard all the evidence, there was a great deal of discussion on this very point. How do we phrase these two questions, and how do I charge the jury? And to answer, I think it was Chief Justice's question, both sides submitted what they wanted to be charged. Each side redlined the other, and the trial judge made the ultimate call with input from both sides. And everyone agreed, is my understanding, on the charge. But toward the very end of the charge conference, and I think this is very, very perceptive of Judge Wilson, he says, you know, there could be more than one contract here. He didn't use those words exactly. He said, you know, there's the bylaw, and everyone seems to agree that could be a contract. The question is what flows from that. But Judge Wilson said, but there could have been another contract here beyond the bylaws. And that's the way I've always looked at this case.
If you're saying that the jury found that the contract was this implied contract of long-term privileges, if not in perpetuity, as long as you're doing your job privileges, then it makes no sense whatsoever that they said there was no breach.
It does, Your Honor, respectfully, if you look at the actual jury charge. The jury was asked twice whether there was a contract. Once was specifically in the context of a breach of the bylaw requiring a hearing. And the jury found, yes, there was a contract, but no, there was a breach. Obviously,
there was no hearing, right?
There was no hearing, but the way it was phrased was the contract breached because of a required hearing. And the jury presumably found that a hearing was not required, either because they believed Valley's argument that we had not put in written notice for it, we didn't trigger that part of the bylaw. So the jury said, no contract breach.
Give us the questions and answers to and from the jury that relate to or arguably relate to this other contract.
That's the second question. And there it was the same question. Was there a contract? And the jury found there was a contract.
You're talking about 4 and 5.
Correct. But there, the breach question, if you will, wasn't based on a breach of the bylaws. It was based on the breach of the covenant. So there was something broader.
But the covenant is a separate, related, but separate claim.
Correct.
So are you saying that there was no breach of contract? The breach of this other, quote unquote, other contract was not presented to the jury as part of a breach of contract claim?
I'm saying two things. I'm saying that there was a contract broader than the bylaws. I'm also saying, and this may not have been pronounced in my brief, but I believe that there are certain narrow circumstances where a breach of the bylaws could yield monetary damages. I disagree with Amiki on that.
But let's move away from the breach of the bylaws. Four and five are the two, the Q&A, the only question and answer that related to this this other contract, such a descriptive name, other contract. And it seems to me there was something rather significant missing from that jury verdict form, and that is, was that contract breached? Was there a contract? Right? Isn't that your standard form?
Yes. Well,
was there a contract? Was there a breach of the contract? Were there damages resulting from that? Well, that's the standard.
The jury was asked that question. Was there a contract?
I get it. There were at that point, but where's the question from the jury about whether that contract was breached?
It was in the charge. And I think Justice Wiener Apter read that part of the charge. It was connected to the implied covenant.
But then you run into, so the charge that I read, I agree with you, talks a lot about general bad faith and unfairness.
Right.
But it seems like where we've ended up is you're arguing that it's not just the bylaws. There is this separate contract and it has these very definite terms. And I think you're arguing that because under our law, in order to have a valid contract, you must have mutual assent, offer and acceptance, consideration, and certainty of terms. So for certainty of terms, you've said the certainty of terms were perpetual use of emergency department call, the gamma knife, and the other thing, biplane, until for as long as we are fulfilling our part of the contract. But then you fall into, you're arguing that was breached. You're not actually arguing that there was a breach of some sort of other implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, because the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing is this idea that Valley couldn't do anything to make your clients not be able to fulfill their portion of the bargain. So it would be like if they didn't let them move their offices or something like that. But here you're actually arguing that Valley did breach this very specific oral side contract.
We're arguing two things. We did argue the breach of the bylaws was a contract entitling us to damages, and the jury disagreed. But I disagree, Justice Wiener Apter, to the extent this is part of your question, that to be awarded implied covenant damages, there has to be a, quote, breach of
the
contract.
No, there has to not be a breach. That's my whole...
Yes, and what we are arguing in this case was, we can argue in the alternative. We argue there was a breach, and if the jury had answered number one, that may have ended the case and they never would have gotten to number two. We don't know. But we're arguing the implied covenant was breached because Valley did what it did to undermine the benefit of the bargain, to deny us our privileges by maneuvering the facts such that they could make a good faith argument or a facial argument, I should say, that the bylaws weren't the right place.
The next question is not about bylaws. Hmm? Was there a jury finding as to whether or not this implied other contract was breached? I don't know where it is. It's not on that verdict sheet.
Well, there are, I would submit respectfully, Justice Patterson, there are a lot of things that don't show up on a verdict sheet, right?
Well, sometimes, but in a contract claim, whether or not it's breached is pretty basic.
And that's why the trial judge, and he was rather insistent on this, he insisted on giving the model charge. And that goes through in great detail where the breach would have been had it been instructed the jury. You have to find offer, acceptance, all of the things that we're trying to figure out, contract, well, where was the offer? How long was this contract?
Contract formation, I'm not talking about contract formation. We have an answer from the jury as to whether there was contract formation. I'm looking at something really major that is missing from the jury findings in this case, and that is in a case where there is a breach of contract on which 30-some million dollars have been awarded here, we don't have an answer as to whether there's a breach of the contract. And respectfully, starting to talk about a different claim, which is the breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, is a different animal. So
I would say the answer two is the breach of the implied covenant. That was asked and that was answered.
Do you agree that a breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing cannot be, by definition, a breach of a contract?
It cannot be, by definition, the same as a breach of a literal term. That's what Wade says.
So then here, what is the difference? You have this contract with these very definite terms as you spelled them out. Emergency department call, the biplane, the gamma knife. We're allowed to use those for as long as we fulfill our end of the bargain. Where is the bad faith action that did not consist of saying you can no longer use ED call, the gamma knife, or the biplane?
This is where you have to look at the whole contractual framework, which in our view includes the bylaws. And I understand the other side says a bylaw breach could never support a covenant breach.
But the reason we disagree with that. We're separating them is because you already said that the jury found that there was no breach of the bylaws.
Correct.
So let's just take the bylaw.
So that helps.
So that I can keep it distinct in my head.
I say that, Your Honor, because I think it supports my Wade analysis. Because the jury found there was no literal breach of the bylaws, then they move on to the implied covenant claim.
Then you're saying that the implied covenant claim is based only on the bylaws. The way I understand the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing is you must have a definite contract that has mutual assent, offer and acceptance, consideration, and certainty of its terms. However, it was not breached. Instead of it being breached, one party acted in bad faith to make the other party not be able to fulfill their end of the bargain.
Our argument is there are many terms to this contract. Many of them are embodied in the bylaws, and some of them are embodied in that part of the contract that extended beyond the bylaws. And when you put those two together, you marry it with the charge, the jury's verdict is sound.
But that's not what happened here. What happened here is that in count four, you've got the bylaws being the premise that the jury is basing its decision about the existence of a contract on. And then in count five, it sounds like you're suggesting today that we're talking about the other contract, that side agreement. But conflating those two would lead to jury confusion if they're going from a breach in one, which they did not find, and then moving on to the implied covenant in count five. Wouldn't that automatically lead to immense jury confusion if there is no physical, actual contract for them to review?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because then we would say we really be diminishing the possibility of oral contracts. And of course, the jury was charged on oral and implied contract. If I may make another point, I think the reason there might be a little confusion, and I do not think the jury was confused here at all, confusion in terms of this discussion, is I disagree with the suggestion of Valley, and there may have been a suggestion by the bench, that there was no formal pleading on this broader contract. I have three responses to that. First is there was factual statement pleading, if you will. It was contained in the summary judgment statement of facts, and I've already given you the cite on that. There was in our summary judgment brief, we talked about that when Valley tried to get our plaintiff's case dismissed and failed. So there was discussion about that. So clearly they were on notice of this broader contract. And three, and maybe this is the most salient, is we have a court rule on this. It's court rule 4:9-2. It's really designed for this type of case. which says it allows for pleadings to be amended by operation of law to conform to evidence. And it gives a sliding sort of process of how that happens.
Would that be conforming after the summary judgment motion was disposed of or before?
The rule goes so far as to say even after judgment. And the reason for that, the reason it's a sliding scale, goes back to my very, very, very first point about this is a jury issue, is Rule 4:9-2, it talks about the process for amending the pleadings to conform to evidence, but then says, Justice Fascione, this is so critical, but failure to so amend shall not affect the result of the trial on these issues. So this is just another example of where the court system is saying, look, this got to the jury, this question. Now, why did it get to the jury? At least three times Valley consented or acquiesced this going to the jury. The very first time, no one's mentioned, was the chancery.
What going to the jury?
The implied covenant claim. And just the whole concept of monetary damages from a breach of the bylaws.
The implied covenant claim as to which contract?
The implied covenant claim as to the contract that the evidence supported. And three times...
The broader contract, not the bylaws.
Under my analysis, it's either one, because I think under these unique facts, a breach of the bylaws could support monetary damages.
Or you said the jury disagreed.
They disagreed that failure to hold a hearing was a breach.
And they also were never given a question asking whether there was a breach of that aspect of the contract. Yeah. And it's when you have a claim set forth in the charges and you present to the jury a series of questions that it's supposed to answer, and one gets skipped, and people make mistakes. I'm not suggesting there's anything insidious about it,
right?
But this is not just some detail in the case. This is at the heart of this case, and the jury never found that they either breached it or they didn't breach it.
Yeah. Let me explain why I respectfully disagree. Even if Your Honor thinks a step was missed, I don't think it was. But let's assume for the purpose of your question.
Let me ask you, you do not think that question should have been answered?
When you marry the charge to the questions that were asked, it all came out in the jury's verdict, and they well understood what they were being asked to do. And if I could just get to those three points. In the Chancery case, when really at that point we were looking for injunctive relief, it was Valley who said, oh, this case is just about money. It probably belongs in the law division. So then we moved to the law division. So right there, this idea that a bylaw breach or a breach of this larger contract could never support what happened here. Valley,
I think that's three. Most lawyers representing defendants who find themselves in chancery and see a damages claim start talking about the law division. I think that's a stretch to say that's a waiver or a recognition that there was a valid contract here.
Your Honor, what Valley said was not, they weren't concerned because they saw a little monetary damage. The direct quote was, this case is all about money. That's what Valley said. But again, it's just not that isolated comment. It's number two. I'm sorry.
In that the plaintiffs were seeking money.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, well, but Your Honor, respectfully, at that point, my clients were seeking an injunction. And it was Valley who said, this case is all about money. You don't get to argue this type of breach in chancery. You don't get an injunction for that. You can't get a hearing for that. This case is about money. So that was number one. Number two is in the summary judgment when they were trying to dispose of the implied covenant claim. They didn't dispose of it because they said it could not go to the jury as a matter of law, which they're saying now. They said it all assimilated into other counts. And then when it came down to the charge, That's exactly what they said. They said you have a public policy claim and you have a fundamental fairness claim. That should all get put into the implied covenant. So to finish the answer, Justice Patterson, if you believe a step was missed, then it clearly is plain error. And then you have to take a step back and say, is this an unjust result, what happened here? And I think the jury, they may not have gotten all the buzzwords correct, but they got the bottom line correct. There is.
I can't speak to anything. Obviously, I wasn't there. And no lawyer even who is there knows what's in the minds of the jury. That's not what I'm addressing. Yeah. I'm addressing whether there may have been a collective mistake here that left a gap in the findings of this jury that make it very difficult to conclude that there was a proper foundation for a breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. Because if they had found a breach of that contract, yes, then that's where you are. That's where your case is. And if they say no, then you have a different case. And we got no answer.
Yeah.
And why? Because the question wasn't asked.
And if that's the case, would a remand be the proper course of action?
A retrial?
On the implied covenant.
Respectfully, I do not think a remand is warranted in this case. And I realize, Justice Patterson, you weren't there. You didn't try this case. But we have so much case law that says that we respect the juries unless there is a manifest injustice.
No, I understood.
And even if there's a flaw in the charge, even if they skipped a step, I think it is proper for this court, with all due respect, Your Honor, it is proper for this court here and now to look at this entire record, including the emails that the other side say should not have been seen, but you have my arguments in the brief. And I think it is very hard pressed on this record to conclude that the jury's verdict was so palpably unfair, the outcome was so unreasonable, that we throw out the results of a 4-week trial.
We're at 35 minutes.
Yes.
I want to make sure you get to emails.
Yes.
Before doing so, I have one question on this, and I see that my friend to the left here has one as well. The paragraph that Justice Winter after read earlier about the theory, DA 82.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give us more specifics about how that paragraph was developed? Who proposed it? Did anyone redline it? And if so, how was it redlined?
I do not have the redline copy. I cannot answer.
Who proposed it?
Both sides proposed jury charges. I cannot speak to who specifically proposed that charge. We could, through the clerk's office, I'm sure, Mr. Perino and I could supply that part of the record. I just don't want to mislead the court. What I do know is both sides proposed charges. They were redlined. The trial judge really hashed down some detail, and he came up with the charge that he did. In terms of the privileged emails, if I just may have...
So I just want to dwell on this for a second. If Valley proposed that charge, that raises a question of invited error. We do not know whether Valley proposed it or whether... Your clients proposed it?
I think it is invited error because Valley agreed to it and didn't object to it. So I don't think...
That would just be plain error, right?
I'm not sure about that because if I'm not mistaken...
You would agree that if they proposed the charge, it's a stronger argument, and that's why I'm pressing...
I would like to have that fact to argue, yes. I just, with my candor to the court, I just don't know the answer to that question. And I'm not sure it's in the record, but it might be.
Maybe it may not be.
Yeah, it may not be. And we would be glad to supplement the record. Mr. Perino and I could do that rather easily.
Are the summary judgment briefs before the trial judge in the record, too? I don't know.
Just the part of the brief, as you know, under the appellate division court rules, you cannot put briefs in. Unless you're arguing a waiver point. We did have an excerpt of the brief, summary judgment brief, Your Honor, that I read to you that laid out the facts of this broader contract. I don't know if the full summary judgment briefs are in the record. I would tend to doubt that because of the appellate division rule.
I have a couple questions.
Yes.
So everybody can just bear with me while I try to get this out. In Mr. Perino's discussion with the court, he said the breach of contract and the breach of the implied covenant are two separate things. Sounds like you agree with that.
They're discrete inquiries, yes.
And if you do not, if you find, well, let me back up. Some time ago, you discussed what the breach of the implied covenant was in this case, and that it did not have a relationship to whether there was a breach of contract or not. There are separate inquiries, there are separate questions. I think that's sort of what you were arguing. I think.
I'm arguing that the contract here consisted of several parts, one of which was the bylaws, one of which was something broader.
To create the contract.
And the contract is included the expectation of the parties, giving both sides the benefit of the bargain. The jury had sufficient evidence in front of it to find there was no actual breach of a term of that contract, but there was a frustration of the benefit.
That's where I want to get.
Yes.
And that is the breach of the implied covenant.
Correct.
And in fact, the trial court heard all this evidence, crafted a charge, and I think you were suggesting that the verdict is exactly consistent with the charge. And I want to draw your attention and everybody's attention to the paragraph above the paragraph that the chief was reading from on DA 82. The second sentence begins, in order for you to find that there was a breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing in this case, the plaintiff must prove to you that the defendant with no legitimate purpose acted with bad motives or intentions or engaged in deception or evasion in the performance of the contract. And is that what you're arguing the jury said yes to? Question 5 on the jury charge.
Yes, I'm arguing that, I don't have that specific language in front of me, but I am arguing that the charge, the overall charge, mindful that we look at the charge as a whole, the overall charge was adequate as a matter of law for the jury to find a breach of the covenant.
Let me read you the last phrase of that charge. By such conduct denied the plaintiff, your client, of the bargain initially intended by the parties.
Yes.
Such that, as to questions 4, 5, and 6 on the jury verdict sheet, which they answered yes to 4, yes to 5, and awarded damages on 6, they said, by a preponderance of the evidence that the Valley Hospital and Comprehensive Neurological PC entered into a contract. Yes, that's the same contract discussed in that paragraph I just read, I assume, and I think that's what your argument was. And question 5, do you find by a preponderance of the evidence that the defendant, the Valley Hospital, violated the covenant of good faith and fair dealing with the purpose of depriving the plaintiffs, Comprehensive Neurological PC, of their reasonably expected rights or benefits under the contract? I think that's exactly what you were arguing.
That's the language.
And I think that's exactly what the court charged. And I think that's exactly what the jury found, except they added in a number for damages that I haven't mentioned.
And I would add one other thing. That's exactly what Valley did not object
to. We're worried about your argument.
Well, thank you.
just to get my...
But it's what I've been saying. You said it better than I could have said it.
How about that?
The charge taken as a whole and the jury verdict taken as a whole are consistent. And particularly on, we'll say, plain error, Your Honor, as opposed to invited error, either one, there is no reasonable basis to upset what occurred in this case. And I would ask the court... Chief Justice, I know I'm at the end of my time. I assume the court doesn't want to hear from me on privileges or the closing statement. I'll rely on my brief, although I do have some responses to say to that. But I would just ask the court to take a step back and look what happened in this case, not as allegations, but what the jury heard and obviously agreed with. This is a semi-public institution that treated these doctors in a way that was unfair. That is clear from the jury's finding. And if this court were to reverse an unpublished opinion to somehow make a point on some technicality, it would be sending an awful message to all the parties in this case, to jurors, to trial courts. No trial is ever perfect. No trial is ever cleaned and pressed.
Before you get to the end there.
Yes.
Give us 2 minutes to flesh out what you said at the outset, that these emails gave more than legal advice.
Yes. So I start with Payton. I start with Justice Handler's decision in Payton. And Payton says that when you are looking at, in Payton it was a review, this is, rather it was an investigation, this is a review. You look at the entire process. You don't just look at the end product, which in this case was the white paper. So if you look at the entire process, you see that the general counsel was involved at the beginning of this process, in the middle, and at the end. In the beginning, there were all kinds of emails that she was either copied on or that she initiated. And she came right out and said, and I think this is one of the most relevant emails, she says, and this is 2526, she says, there's nothing we can do if they have privileges. Now, the context there is the CEO wanted to get rid of my clients and is basically asking, how do we do this? And the GC says, there's nothing we can do if they have privileges. The only thing we can do is close the service. Do we have an appetite for this? Now, I would submit that's not generic legal advice. That's in line with what every other person under the CEO was doing and saying, which is, we got to help them get rid of our clients. And they went so far as to say in one of these emails, maybe we need to go to the nuclear option. And the VP at the hospital's response was kaboom, meaning blow them up. So the jury heard all of this. And also the jury did hear about legitimate healthcare reasons. Both sides were arguing that. Valley was arguing that as well.
Is Valley correct that there was a protective order with a clawback procedure?
The judge found that the privilege was waived, so the clawback was inoperable. That's my understanding. That the Judge Toscas did an in-camera review, saw all of these emails in context, and he said the privilege was waived, so they don't get clawed back. I mean, that was the point, I believe, of the in-camera inspection. And by the way, the clawback came, the alleged clawback came many, many weeks later. And as Judge Toscas found, these documents were marked confidential and so forth. I think witnesses were asked about in deposition. So there's certainly no inadvertence here. This was not 6 or 7 emails of the GC sandwiched in between non-privileged emails. But Valley turned over these emails because it was part of the process that mistakenly they thought would hold up to scrutiny, but obviously it didn't because of the data was manipulated and so forth. So, Your Honor, there's that email, and there are other emails where it's very, very clear going back and forth with the CEO that the GC was involved in the beginning of the process. The GC is also on calendar invites. She's meeting with the analysts, meeting with the subordinates to the CEO throughout this process. And then, if that were not enough to make the cheese more binding, as Justice Stein would say, she begins to negotiate the contract with the rival group, the GC. So Judge Toscas looked at this and he said, this is in waiver. This is in issue waiver. I mean, this is almost a textbook case of it. So, and these emails weren't weaponized. The suggestion that the GC was harshly questioned and so forth. The GC was put on the stand like every witness and was asked questions in a professional manner. The jury heard the GC and made its decision. So that's the waiver position.
Thank you. Would you like to close out your argument?
Yes, just close out my argument. Again, the closing statement, very, very different than what you saw in the other cases. I'll rely on my brief. I would just go back to how I began, that I don't want to say jury verdicts are absolutely sacrosanct, but it's pretty close. And when they're properly charged, which we think they were, And when they deliberate the way they did, where they made the credibility findings that they made, and there were credibility findings to be made because some of these witnesses just simply were not credible, it's incumbent upon our system, the appellate court system, to respect that finding. Otherwise, we are going to be unraveling all sorts of cases in all manner of ways, and that's not what our system was designed to do. The just result happened in this case. We urge the court to leave this case where it found.
Thank you. Mr. Perino, rebuttal.
Thank you, Justices. I'll try and answer a couple of the questions that I think are still open. Chief Justice, you had asked about the genesis of that aspect of the charge relating to the covenant. What I can tell you is that in Valley's reply brief to the Appellate Division, December 14, 2020, at pages 18 to 20, we explain that Valley objected to the contention charges. And there was lots of colloquy on that. You can go back and read it.
You said the contention charges?
Yeah, the party's contentions. One party contends this, the other party contends that. And included in those contention charges was similar language to the language that got charged on the breach of the implied covenant. And the statements in the appellate brief set forth that history and go on to explain that those objections were overruled. And that further objection to that language, which was very similar later on in the charge, would have been futile. Anyway, the language came from, to answer your question directly, it's our understanding that the language came from the plaintiffs.
Was there any suggestion is it your contention that the jury verdict form should have, because the breach of contract earlier section in question two and three, had been limited to the issue of bylaws and a hearing, is it your contention that to be complete, the jury verdict form should have asked the jury whether there was a breach of this broader or other contract that we've been talking about today?
There's an answer to a question about breach of contract in item two, which Justice, you're aware of. The question of whether the oral contract, the beyond the bylaws contract, however implied contract, whatever you want to describe it, that question is not here. Instead, what you have is the breach of the implied covenant. And of course, as we've talked about now ad nauseum, what the plaintiffs are really saying is that their forever privilege agreement was breached or violated. That's a breach of contract. There's not a jury finding here that there was a breach of contract.
If the jury was properly charged on that issue, but simply not asked to record its finding on the verdict sheet, is there a problem?
Well, the reason I would suggest that there is a little confusion here is because the beyond the bylaws agreement, the oral agreement, wasn't pled. If you look back at the amended complaint, there are allegations about coming to the hospital, the plaintiffs arriving, and them talking to President Myers, and them building out this neuroscience practice. But there's no allegation of an agreement. And when you look at the summary judgment record that Mr. Venero referred to, that doesn't allege an agreement either.
I understand your argument and the dispute between counsel on that point. If the charge nonetheless was proper, and there simply wasn't a place on the jury verdict sheet to record, is there a problem?
There is a problem, a major problem. This isn't as Justice Patterson said, this isn't a detail. This is the case. And we would have been arguing that you're alleging breach of this oral contract, which you didn't prove. So this is, I don't know if it was intentional or unintentional. I'm not making any judgments about it. But there's a reason that there's lack of clarity and confusion. And it's because these claims were never squarely asserted. That was, and again, I'm not saying it was done on purpose or wasn't done on purpose, but they were never squarely asserted, so they were never squarely addressed, and we sort of slipped into this, you know, this confusion. Did I answer your question, Chief Justice?
Please go ahead.
I'll just wrap up briefly by saying, just try and step back for a moment and understand what was happening here at Valley Hospital and this neuroscience group, neurosurgery group. They came on board and they did what doctors do. And I think by all counts, in those early years, they did what the hospital hoped they would do. But then the plaintiffs made a decision, which they were entitled to make. They had the right to decide that they wanted to spend more time at Hackensack. They wanted to allocate resources to acquire a gamma knife at Hackensack and have Hackensack pay them for the lease of that gamma knife. They decided that they would only do 4.7% in total of the total plaintiff's practice, their total revenue derived from Valley Hospital by 2014 is 4.7%. They decided that they were going to do things elsewhere, and that's their privilege. It was within the hospital's discretion to decide that they wish to enter an exclusive arrangement. Exclusive arrangements are favored. We don't have to guess about why they make sense. It's set forth in the cases that talk about them. The notion of collaboration, familiarity, economic efficiency, it all feeds into why exclusive arrangements make sense. Valley Hospital did what it was entitled to do. It entered an exclusive arrangement with the Columbia Group, which, by the way, the plaintiffs had already said they didn't want. Now, the 4.7% that was reduced to some degree, and by the way, just to be clear, they didn't lose their privileges, all of them. They were still able to treat their own patients at Valley Hospital, but they were curtailed. So some measure of that 4%, 4.7% of their revenue was also going to be curtailed, and that's why they filed this lawsuit. They had the right to move away and to decide that they were going to spend more time and devote more resources and take on more leadership roles at Hackensack and resign leadership roles at Valley. But we also had the right and the discretion to enter an exclusive contract with Columbia. I just want to see if there are any other questions, if you just give me one moment.
Let me just follow up on something that was mentioned earlier, just ask if there's an issue or not. Is there any contention in this case that because there were only two doctors at the time that this implied contract that plaintiffs are alleging, and later there were 12 doctors. Is there any contention that there is sort of a lack of the contracting party was something other than the current or later doctors who comprise comprehensive neurosurgical PC? See what I'm saying?
I think what you're asking is that, you know, the purported understanding is reached with two doctors and there ends up being lots of other doctors as part of the practice.
Is it, well, did comprehensive neurosurgical PC exist at that time?
I'm not sure if the entity existed per se, but it...
It's late in the game to make a contention now, obviously, but was there any contention on the part of Valley that what are we talking about here? Even the allegation was that there were two doctors involved. It was not the same entity.
I'd have to check the record. It is absolutely the case that, you know, the purported oral arrangement did not include all of the doctors who subsequently came on board. They were not part of the group at the time this supposed arrangement, never pled arrangement, was made. And one other thing I should mention is I think there's been a suggestion that, you know, that they were promised forever privileges, including forever privileges of the biplane and the gamma knife. The biplane and the gamma knife didn't exist at the time the alleged oral agreement was made. That came later. So this agreement wasn't pled because it didn't exist. We kind of slipped into the notion of another agreement when they ran into the trouble they had with the bylaws. I will rest on the briefs and thank you, justices for your time.
Thank you. Thank you to all counsel for the very helpful argument.